speak to us. It needs its coffee about now.
Yeah.
Good. Terrific. And I assume the arrows just work. Yeah. Thank you very much. And actually, this is a really nice follow-on to some of the prior work that's been done here, because we've talked about the challenges of expanding coverage, and then we've talked about the challenges of the safety net. And in some respects, our talk is going to focus on where the rubber hits the road, is that once, if you have insurance, that's not enough to generate access. And what are some of the factors that really lie behind the linchpin of whether or not providers are opening their doors to accept the patients that have the insurance coverage? So in doing that, I'm going to basically, we have no disclosures on this, but I want to thank my co-author, David Newman, who's sitting in the audience and will answer all difficult questions. And in particular, the man bolting for the door at the moment. And in particular, thank our funders, who include the Commonwealth Fund, the California Endowment, and AHRQ for giving us the opportunity to collect some really cool data that we're going to talk to you about a little bit today in one dimension. So anyway, here's the problem, and this is in many ways preaching to the choir, because you guys know this, is that, you know, Medicare and Medicaid really form a good portion of the backbone of the social safety net in terms of providing care for individuals who may not have access to care otherwise. But a critical aspect about the viability of these programs is really dependent upon whether providers out in the community, physicians and hospitals, are accepting patients. This is a particularly keen issue because we've heard a lot of debate on both sides about whether or not expansions in Medicare and Medicaid-like models might work for the uninsured and what the costs might be. And we've also heard a fair bit of revolt from the provider community, who are faced with increasing costs and generally flat payment rates, about their ability to continue to accept patients and de facto subsidize the cost of care. And so the impressions about the attractiveness of the two programs really differ. In particular, we've heard from many of the provider organizations, and particularly in Texas, the percentage of physicians in Texas accepting new Medicare patients has declined to an all-time low of 58% in 2008. And this came from the Texas Medical Association. And in particular, it's not a surprise that they might be saying this, because those of you who follow Medicare policy know that there are some pretty sharp reductions in payments to physicians that are on the horizon, and that this is in many ways if not a problem already, potentially an increasing problem. On the other hand, the Congressional Budget Office found that more than 90% of physicians participate in Medicare Part B, so, you know, sort of what's the problem? 90% is not 100%, and beneficiaries do not experience difficulties accessing care. There's a bit of a disconnect between those two. AMA survey of nearly 9,000 physicians showed that 60% plan to limit the number of new Medicare patients, and even greater limits if payments are cut. So in many ways, there is a disconnect in terms of what the reality is out there. Medicaid payments, we know, are lower, in some states markedly lower than Medicare rates. And we've again heard a much higher propensity of problems of individuals who have Medicaid coverage, and as just mentioned in the last presentation, having a difficult time finding a provider who will accept their Medicaid coverage. And payment is frequently cited as one of the issues behind this. So let me tell you a little bit about the preview of our findings, even though we've only got 15 minutes, and be happy to talk about later. What matters in accepting this? Well, price matters. And as an economist, that in many ways sort of warms the inside of my heart, but it also is a very important policy lever, because this is something that we can change. This is one of the potentially the fastest change policy levers that we can pull on, although not always the easiest to exact. The type of primary care physician matters. In many ways, we see that, you know, that there's a distinct difference between acceptance between when we look at children, whether it's pediatrics or internal medicine, when we look at adults, between internal medicine, family practice, and other primary care providers. In general, the more specialized the provider, and we're looking only at primary care physicians in our study, the more the specialized the provider, the less likely they're going to be accepting patients. And this, again, raises some concerns, particularly for patients that may have chronic illness or essentially more acute and higher degrees of severity. Whether the physician is trained in the U.S. matters. We've heard this a lot anecdotally, that IMGs have a tendency to be opening their doors more often to individuals who are being covered by safety net programs, and in fact we find this in our study. Gender and race of the physician matter. Physicians who are minorities tend to be accepting more patients, all else equal. And this, again, bodes well for cultural competency, but we know there aren't a lot of minority physicians out there. And again, this raises questions about access. State-specific design matters. There's huge variation across the states. And a lot of this has to do with other types of policies the state had under their control in terms of their ability to pay physicians promptly in order to develop some coherent packages that are acceptable to providers. And so, again, there are some policy levers to pull on here. Community and environmental factors may have a significant impact as well, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But practice size and structure don't systematically matter, and this is, again, a little bit different, and again, may bode well for patients that are tend to be seeing physicians in smaller or larger practices. And again, we'll talk a little bit about this. Medicaid literature, yes, there are people who've come before us and they've enlightened our studies. And again, sort of what drives this acceptance decision is in many ways open to debate, and very different findings have been uncovered by people who've done a very good job in the literature. Some people have pointed to price as being essentially the most robust lever for getting the doors open. Other folks have said, nah, you know, reimbursement doesn't matter as much as a lot of the contextual stuff going on in the community, whether you're facing a lot of uninsured, basically some other idiosyncratic factors about the practice. Let me tell you a little bit about our data, and I hope to be back before this audience perhaps in another year telling you a little bit more about this. We had just recently completed a large study of primary care physicians. It was funded by ARC, the California Endowment, and the Commonwealth Fund. We fielded and completed it in 2007, so it's pretty robust, and in fact, it may be some of the most recent large-scale data on primary care physician practices that exist. It was a multi-mode survey, both mail and web, and we had a response rate of itching up close to 70%, and which is extraordinarily rare in these days. The way we did it is we stapled a $100 check to the cover of this and sent our cover letter out by essentially a primary care physician and pediatrician, and I think it captured people's sense of importance. I'll leave it at that. Our sample frame were primary care physicians, general family practice, general practice, general internal medicine, and general pediatrics. We were sampling in five states: California, Georgia, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Texas. Minority physicians and pediatricians were oversampled for a variety of reasons, particularly minority physicians, because we really wanted to drill down on some of the issues of cultural competency and physician and patient matching. And if you do simply a random sample, minority physicians are still such a small slice of the pie, you can't say very much substantial about it. Sampling weights adjust for all the usual suspects. And in general, the five states were chosen for a variety of reasons, but one of them was to take a look at diversity in Medicaid practice across the states. So we feel that we've got some pretty good traction for saying some things about how Medicaid programs are different. In particular, you can contrast California, Illinois, and Texas. You get a fair bit of not only geographic separation, but policy separation. What did we ask? And we're going to use some of this information, but this may whet your appetite for those of you who are interested in data on primary care physician practice. Please come and see me because we're happy to share. Our survey domains looked at physician characteristics and demographics, all the usual stuff, practice characteristics, size, scope, organization of the practice, a number of questions about the availability as well as use of different aspects of health information technology, workload, numbers of patients seen, types of patients, kind of administrative stuff that was done, ownership, practice revenues and earnings. You know, again, I'm an economist. We're going to look at the financial stuff. We also had some clinical vignettes in there where we asked physicians how you would treat patients that were, well, there were two. One was a patient that had moderate persistent asthma, and a second was a patient with mild depression. And needless to say, there was a tremendous amount of variation. Physician training and demographic data from the AMA master file, which was our sampling frame. Community attributes, variables, were taken from the U.S. Census at the zip code level. And again, this gives us a lot better traction. We did have physician zip code to look at the immediate community around the physician's practice, which we thought would be really important and turned out to be much less important than we imagined. Again, a sample of roughly 2,967 respondents. This is our locational distribution. Again, these are weighted data, and California is, by virtue of its largest size, the largest portion of the sample, but a large number of physicians across all five states. Fair bit of good distribution across primary care practices. Office practice size, again, almost 80% of our sample was office-based, but we also had physicians who were hospital-based, based in a community health center, based in a university and a hospital, and other. And we'll find that the facility to open the doors and accept patients varies tremendously. In particular, we are concerned about physicians who are in office-based practices having, in many ways, some greater reluctance to accept publicly insured patients. And again, this raises concerns for policymakers because part of the impetus is to attempt to move patients into access around mainstream medicine. Let's see, anything else? Solo practice, again, following in general the distribution of physicians in the U.S. today. A lot of providers still are in reasonably small practice settings. All right, let's get to the grist of this. How many docs said they're going to be actually accepting the two programs? First of all, we're not sure who the Texas Medical Association is talking to in their membership, largely the disgruntled folks. But acceptance of Medicare, pediatrics is a little bit of a downplay. Not many docs see very many Medicare patients, but many indicated that they would be happy to accept them, largely on SSI and other types of programs. But roughly about 80% of physicians are accepting Medicare. Now, if you take a look, essentially, other evidence of this, there's some evidence that that number is drifting downward, but certainly not at the point of 50% or lower, which some of the medical societies have touted. However, still 80%, given the size of the elderly population and the concentrations of where some of these folks are, is a number to be concerned about. That certainly does not suggest universal access and acceptability. Medicaid is, in many ways, a much more difficult problem, where we find that if we take a look at internal medicine and family and general practitioners, we are hovering around 50%. And this raises some serious questions in the minds of policymakers about the ability to expand effective access in a Medicaid look-alike program. By state, again, it's a fair bit of variation in terms of acceptance. Our Illinois is our best state, and perhaps we can find out a little bit about whether they're doing a little bit better, but still reasonably low numbers. Key payment points. We know that Medicare rates vary across and within states, but are set geographically. Medicaid rates as well are set by the state with much less geographic variation. Commercial payment rates vary across and within geography. And so what we're going to be doing is we're going to be making use of information we have in our data about how much the physician is paid by commercial payers in their marketplace relative to what they would have been paid from the public payers. And so it's that gap that I can get $100 for a commercial office visit but only $42 for Medicaid that drives, in many ways, the acceptance decision. It's not so much how much the state pays, but it's how much you pay relative to what the practice can get from a commercial payer. Our estimation strategy is essentially looking at, we do logistic regressions, weighted for complex sample design. We build a series of sequential models because all these things are somewhat related. And the trick in the policy game is to try to disentangle things so you can send clear signals about what lever to pull on. What do we find? Well, in general, what we find are selected physician characteristics as well as price are the key factors that drive participation. We're going to focus on Medicaid because this is really of key policy interest. Essentially, what's significant? Well, in general, if you're a U.S. medical graduate, you're about 30% less likely, all else equal, to be accepting a Medicaid patient than somebody who's an IMG. If you're in internal medicine relative to the other primary care specialties, again, about 30% less likely, and we've translated these into effective elasticities. Black physicians and Hispanic physicians, we get a bump. Are all else equal in their practices more likely to be accepting patients? And if you raise your Medicaid payment rate to equal roughly the commercial rate in your community, you increase the probability of acceptance by about 13%. And that's pretty significant. That's pretty significant, but that's also pretty costly. On Medicare, we see it send the same physician characteristics, but much less of a boost in terms of price. There's less of a gap to close. This is statistically significant, but economically, again, it's less of a potent lever. What have we learned? Well, price and reimbursement policy matters. There's a significant gap, and a good way to close it is essentially to reimburse providers commensurate to what commercial rates are, which increasingly is getting closer to their costs. There isn't a lot of margin for you doing this. Other state-level design factors matter as well, and one of the key issues here is to try to figure out what Illinois is doing right, and Pennsylvania is doing right, and Texas is doing wrong in terms of making it acceptable. As well as this, IMGs accept more publicly reimbursed payments. Visa and training structures are getting more difficult, and this doesn't bode well for the programs down the road. And minority physicians, especially blacks, accept more Medicare and Medicaid patients. Increasing diversity may promote much better access, but the caution is that minority physicians practice in very different communities, and there aren't a lot of them today, so this isn't going to be a short-term fix.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We don't have time for questions this moment, but we should have a few minutes at the end. I was a little disturbed by the fact, I'm an internist and pediatrician and U.S. grad, and I'm a little disturbed by their non-acceptance of patients. But anyway, we'll get into that later.
You didn't get the memo?
I'm with the county hospital system, so I don't care who I get at this point. Okay. This is... Again, the...